Hello everyone, welcome back to Peel Pod, brought to you by Peel UK. I'm your host, Rosrin.
And Steffi.
And Jocelyn. And today we are joined with the fabulous Becky Milan. Becky, would you like to go ahead and introduce yourself?
Yeah, well, first of all, thank you both for having me. I'm excited to speak with you all. As Jocelyn mentioned, my name is Becky Milan. I am a responsible business lead at the Fair Trade Foundation, overseeing all of our retail partnerships. If my accent hasn't given me away already, I am actually from the US originally. I grew up in Florida and I went to a small university called Wake Forest in North Carolina, where I studied international affairs and Spanish interpreting. It was there that I really found my passion for human rights. I worked very closely with an organization at the time was called Students Helping Honduras. It's now called 1000 Schools. As well as having the opportunity to serve as an interpreter in a hospital clinic for a lot of farmers and workers in the region. Wake is in a pretty rural area who unfortunately were a lot of the times in exploitative situations due to their undocumented status. So I learned a lot at Wake Forest, and it was really the time that I had firsthand experience with some of the biggest issues facing society today when it comes to human rights. And from there, I went to work at Deloitte, which seems like an interesting transition, but I wanted to really build my business acumen, understand what it's like to be a big corporate business. And there I really did have the opportunity to work with companies across all different sectors, including technology businesses, but also with the government in the US as well. So an interesting experience, seeing how the corporate world works. But internally to the firm, I was able to co-lead what we called our anti-human trafficking initiative. And it was really in that work that I decided officially that I wanted my career to be really focused on businesses and human rights. And so from there, I moved here to the UK. I completed a master's at LSC studying international development. And ended up first off working for a small charity called Stop the Traffic, where I headed up their consulting and advisory teams focused specifically on modern slavery prevention. And then ended up moving to Fair Trade, where I started working last year in 2023.
That's brilliant. Thank you so much for that introduction. It's so fascinating, your journey from sort of NGO to the corporate world and then back again to the NGO world. The transition is a really brilliant one, I think, to really understand the corporation mindset and then work to sort of do your best to change business practices that aren't necessarily having a positive impact on communities around the world. In a few words, could you introduce the Fair Trade Foundation to our listeners?
Yeah, completely. So Fair Trade Foundation is just one part of the global fair trade system, which at its core is a certification given to agricultural goods and products, things such as cocoa, bananas, coffee, cotton, even wine, all of which meet a set standard for protecting both the environment and also upholding human rights. Our listeners may know it as the green and blue logo that you find on some of your favorite food items, things like chocolate, Tony's Chocolonely, but also cups of coffee that you find at Greg's, for instance. So you can see our logo in many different spaces in the UK. But the Fair Trade Foundation is the UK arm of the global system. And we're really focused on supporting businesses to purchase and sell fair trade products, as well as raising awareness of challenges that farmers and producers are facing on a global scale, both with consumers, but also with our government, and advocating for farmers and workers within UK policy itself.
Thank you. That's a very clear overview. When you're speaking, I was wondering, could you give us a little bit more insight on what the certification actually entails? So when you're a consumer and you say, buy a fair trade banana, how high is the standard you're setting?
Yeah, so I think the certification itself can be a pretty complex system. We have many different actors and pieces involved in ending up with a logo on a cup of coffee, for instance. But in its simplest terms, for a producer group, be it a small producer organization like a cooperative or a hired labor organization, for them to be able to certify their goods, they must meet what we call the fair trade standards that are applicable to their organization as well as the commodity that they're growing. And they must continue to be able to demonstrate these standards through passing a fair trade specific audit that's conducted by our third party independent group called FlowCert. So as I mentioned, there are different standards depending on what you grow and how you grow it. So we recognize that people that are a hired labor organization with workers is very different from small producer organizations, which tend to be families joined in a cooperative that are earning income versus wages. So their standards vary based on that. But there's also standards for different commodities. So how you grow coffee is very different to how you grow cotton or how you produce wine. And there's also standards for traders within the supply chain as well. So it's not just at the farmer and worker level that we have standards that need to be met. Traders within the supply chain also need to meet the standards. So you have across the supply chain that certification. So it's not just at the end of the supply chain. And I think an important piece to recognize is that we as fair trade also know that we have high standards for what it means to protect the environment and to uphold human rights. These things do not happen overnight, especially when you're working with some really vulnerable communities and who are facing the brunt of a lot of challenges we're seeing globally, like climate change. So within the standards themselves, there's actually over time requirements increase. So to enter into the fair trade system, we have a base set of requirements, but at the 1, 3, and 6 year marks, we're expecting to see additional requirements that are being met by these producer groups. And it also, we don't want these producer groups to do it alone. So I think we as a system recognize that in order to meet these requirements, there's a lot of investment and time and support that's needed to do so. So we have what I think is probably the most unique part about fair trade and the most important part, in my opinion, about fair trade, called our producer networks. These are regional networks. We have three, one in Africa, one in Latin America and the Caribbean, and the other in Asia Pacific. These are networks that producer organizations may join if they wish, and it allows them access to representation within their own regions and support. So our producer networks are on the ground working with farmers on year round in supporting them with meeting new standards as our standards are changing to meet market demand, but also to meet new challenges that we're facing globally. So they provide support to meeting those changes. And they also provide access to amplify voice. So really at the heart of what we do, if standards are changing or if we need to influence policy, we access these networks to amplify producer voice and everything that we're doing. So I would say that's really at the heart of it. I know that was a very complex explanation of how our standards are met. So there's a lot of different working pieces, but really at the heart of it is the standards, but knowing that meeting those standards takes time and takes support. So we have a system built around that to support farmers globally.
No, that's really fantastic. Thank you so much. It was a very comprehensive and interesting explanation. Could you clarify to our listeners exactly which issues in global supply chains the fair trade system is trying to address?
Yeah, I think at its heart, fair trade is really looking to change the food trade system and make it fairer for farmers and workers around the world. To do this, I think I've already touched on, we really work across the supply chain, and we're working with all supply chain actors, from farmers and workers to traders to brands and retailers, but also the very end of the supply chain with shoppers, with schools and government. So we're engaging a wide range of stakeholders who are all invested in supply chains one way or another, to ultimately pay fairer prices and to uphold fair production standards and practices. We want to create a world where farmers can enjoy secure and sustainable livelihoods, where they can fulfill their potential and ultimately choose a future that they want. And so that's, I think, our biggest mission and goal. And we do that in a variety of ways, but the certification, that's our ultimate aim.
Thank you for making that even clearer. How would you say the fair trade system can help to protect producers against like price fluctuations in the commodity supply chains?
Yeah, so I'm sure as our listeners know, I think in the agricultural space, price fluctuation is one of the biggest challenges, especially for farmers and labor organizations. You can, year on year, the price changes drastically, and it makes it really difficult to plan financially and to make longer term investments. So when you are looking and seeking for solutions around climate change, resilience, those are long term investments. Those are not overnight fixes. And if you don't have sustainable and projected income based on price fluctuation, it's really hard to invest and fix these problems. And so this is probably one of the biggest things fair trade aims to fix, in creating fairer prices. And to do that, a buyer to buy on what we call fair trade terms and to use that fair trade mark, so to have a mark on pack, buyers commit to paying both what we call the fair trade premium, as well as, if the market price is lower, what we call the fair trade minimum price. So the fair trade minimum price is set, again, in consultation with farmers and traders, and ultimately guarantees that farmers receive a price that covers their costs regardless of what's happening in the market. And at time of purchase, if the market price is higher than the fair trade minimum price, traders, in accordance to the standards, must pay the market price. So we're never shortchanging farmers in that sense. If the market price is higher, they will receive a higher price, but it serves as almost a safety net. So if the market is fluctuating and it ends up at time of purchase, it's lower, they will always receive that fair trade minimum price. And our hope is that that creates a sense of security for farmers to be able to make future and longer term investments, both within their farms or within their organizations. And then there's the fair trade premium. So to buy on fair trade terms, not only are you paying that minimum price, you're paying what we call our fair trade premium. And this is an additional sum of money. So depending on the volume of the commodity you're purchasing, you're paying an additional sum that goes directly to the producer group that then the cooperative democratically decides how to invest. We've seen across the world a wide range of how that premium is spent and all sorts of sustainable initiatives, including both environmental initiatives, so investing in things like biodiversity, but as well as economic development projects. So one of my favorites is we're seeing in Argentina an investment in a healthcare center. And so that premium is being used on a wide range, but the community and a group of farmers is democratically deciding on how to use that.
That's really brilliant. That's really, really interesting. And related to the fair trade premium and the fair trade minimum price, there's also the fair trade living income reference price. Is there a particular obligation on companies? I know Tony Chocolonely pays the living income reference price. Could you tell us a little bit about the living income reference price, why Fairtrade decided to develop this price, and which companies pay it and which don't, and sort of their different reasonings for for it?
Yeah, so it's not an obligation currently to pay at the reference price, but we have developed the reference price and continue to develop it, because depending on region and commodity, if it's a wage or an income, there's a variety of methodologies and matrices. So it can be really difficult for a business actually to know what is the living wage price and where is that benchmark, because there's a lot of different opinions on what that is depending on where and what commodity a farmer is growing. And so fair trade is well positioned, and we see ourselves as well positioned to know what we believe to be that benchmark for a wage and income. And we work very closely with our partners to understand what that difference is for farmers and workers. I think there's a lot that goes into a wage. I think there's things like in-kind benefits that people don't necessarily think about that are contributing to those wages and those incomes. And so we work very closely with our partners to understand what that gap is. And they make that decision as a business of if that's something they can commit to paying. Recently in the news, you might have seen that Sainsbury's have announced that they have closed the living wage gap in bananas. And they've done that in partnership with us. They have 100% commitment. So every banana you buy in Sainsbury's is fair trade. And in that sense, they were able to really make that commitment with us because their whole banana supply chain is fair trade. And so they know that differential and that gap through us, and it's not through all different supply chain actors. And so they were able to make that commitment. And year on year, as that difference might change based on market or changes in the areas that they're buying, and they've committed to paying that differential. So there are businesses that are actively paying living incomes and living wages, and more businesses are making that commitment across commodities, which is really exciting. And I would say fair trade isn't doing this in a vacuum. We're doing this with other organizations like IDH, and we use standard methodology like the anchor methodology. So there's a lot that goes into it. So it's probably why you're seeing more and more come out. We're continually investing in the research and the resource needed to understand what those gaps are, and then ultimately work with our partners who have those long-term commitments and very large commitments to start actively paying those prices.
Thank you for that answer. It's great. And actually got me thinking about how fair trade operates in like a more general manner and like with regards to other authorities. And I was kind of thinking with, for example, the new EU legislation that's being developed. We talk about it more in our other podcasts, such as the UDR, the CSDDD. Would you say that fair trade is filling a regulatory gap, something that should be addressed by the state or by more like institutions? And if it is filling a gap, what would you say that gap is?
I would say that fair trade isn't necessarily filling a gap, but supporting businesses to meet that regulation. Fair trade in itself is not compliance to legislation. I think just because a business might source fair trade goods doesn't negate their responsibility to do their own due diligence and their own effort. We're there as a support for them to amplify those efforts and ultimately create deeper relationships with the ends of their supply chains that they might not have access to before. And I think that's where fair trade is strongest, is that we have these producer networks. We're able to connect end retailers and brands to actually the farmers that they're sourcing from, where they might not have been able to have that relationship before. I think you've seen some amazing brands invest heavily in their fair trade relationships to build those connections. Ben & Jerry's is just one of those brands. They've done a lot of work to build our partnership with fair trade to ultimately build relationships with farmers that they're working with. An example is within their cocoa supply chains, where they have close relationships with the cooperatives that they're sourcing from and do additional investments. So beyond the premium, beyond the fair trade minimum price, but investing in what a program that they now call the Living Income Accelerator. So some of their biggest commodities like vanilla and cocoa, they're investing additional money alongside fair trade to support these farmers. So I do think that's where fair trade serves as a strong partner when tackling legislation like the due diligence legislation that might come into effect, as well as EUDRs, that we're here to build those relationships with producers that they might not have before. And I think, you know, fair trade has always been a strong advocate for deforestation regulation, as well as other due diligence legislations, with the aim to always have farmers first. I think new regulations can really be groundbreaking in advancing human rights, in fighting adverse effects of climate change. But this is really only if companies carry out their mandate fairly, and if the legislation it put in place is in consultation and in dialogue with producers. I think this is something that we recognize, is that fairness doesn't come automatically. Just because there's a legislation in place doesn't mean that it will be implemented fairly. And we see this as a key challenge in the coming years as we're seeing that growing legislation. We don't want fair trade to, as fair trade and as working with our partners, we don't want to leave an undue burden on already vulnerable sourcing partners. And it's really important, I think, for businesses to keep open dialogue with the workers and with the producers in their supply chains as they start to implement changes because of the legislation that's in place. So I think that's really at the heart of it, is although this legislation is great, and I think it will push businesses to do more now that there are financial implications if they don't. I think it's important that within these changes, they are talking to producers on the ground, and they're not just placing the burden on these producers, because otherwise we risk leaving them behind. So within, I think, our own remit, and I think I'm going a lot more beyond your initial question, but I think within our own remit as fair trade, we recognize this, and we recognize that fairness isn't going to come automatically, and that we need to be working in partnership with the farmers and workers within our system to meet these changes, and to not leave them to just do it on their own and hope that it works out for the best. And so we're taking critical action to ensure that while as a certification, we can say we're supporting businesses to meet this new regulation, we're not leaving farmers unsupported with some real heavy requirements. I mean, if you're thinking about EUDR, they're having to plot, geolocate their farms, and also then have data that's in a shareable format for different actors within their supply chain. And that does not come cheaply. That's not something that can be done overnight. And so, especially when you're looking at farms that are just now on the journey to digitizing their finance books, or digitalization in itself is not something that comes overnight. So there are a lot of really minute details in this legislation that farmers need support with. So this is why I think as Fair Trade, we've, for example, partnered with an organization called Sawtelligence. So we're aiming to connect fair trade cooperatives, firstly in cocoa and coffee, because that's within our remit and within the legislative requirements, to connect farmers with data on their members' farms and on their deforestation risks. So Sawtelligence is going to provide information around potential deforestation risks through geolocation data. And what's, I think, really special about this partnership is that the data is then owned by the farmers themselves. We do not own this data as Fair Trade. We've enabled this partnership to happen and are enabled to provide the support to these farmers and collectives. But at the end of the day, they own this data. And that means that they can better manage their forest landscapes beyond Fair Trade, and also have bargaining power in a sense that they didn't have before. They now can provide this data to traders that they want to be working with. And I think that's a really exciting piece to this, is that you have the opportunity with this legislation, if done right, to really shift the power dynamics within what at times are very exploitative supply chains. So this is just one way that we're doing that.
That was brilliant. Thank you so much. And so exciting that with Fairtrade's partnership with Sawtelligence, that farmers are going to own the data. I think that is something that hasn't happened often before, and is a huge problem within commodity supply chains and supply chains as a whole, is that so often it's corporations and companies in the global north that own the data and not the farms themselves. And so that has huge, in fact, for us, huge environmental and trade justice ramifications, which is really, really exciting. You mentioned the impacts of climate change and the capacity of farmers to be able to adapt to climate change impacts and also mitigate greenhouse gas emissions. Could you tell us, like, what kind of impacts climate change is currently having on farmers' livelihoods? I know it will vary a lot depending on sector and on region, but it would be really interesting to hear.
Yeah, I think as a lot of probably our listeners know, unfortunately, millions of producers worldwide are on the front line of the climate emergency. So although in the UK we're seeing those impacts, people who are our producers and making our food and growing our food are really at the front of the forefront of the climate emergency today. But they're also among those who contributed the least to the climate crisis, and yet they're feeling the worst of its effects. And those effects are ever threatening their livelihoods. I think we've seen in just the last 5 years, we've seen natural disasters completely devastate crops, like floods in Pakistan or the back-to-back Category 5 hurricanes in Honduras. This leaves producers without a means to make income if their crops are completely destroyed at growing season. There's also the dangers and the more subtle changes of climate change. I think longer rains, droughts, this means to farmers a decline in productivity. It means introduction of new pests that are destroying crops. We've seen that in bananas, as well as making it really difficult to introduce new crop varieties. So things like biodiversity, these subtle changes makes it really difficult to introduce those new varieties into farms. So I think what climate change is ultimately showing us is how deeply interlinked the E is to the S in ESG. In my previous role at Stop the Traffic, I think we witnessed how things like forced migration due to drought is increasing vulnerability to exploitation and trafficking in places like Ethiopia. And all of this is an expensive problem to fix. I think I mentioned that before. These things like biodiversity and these expectations around climate resilience, it's expensive. So this is why it's so important to stress that adaptation, although we have a huge toolkit of solutions as a globe, I think it's important to stress that these adaptations can't be required without necessary support. So this looks like ensuring that funding reaches the world's poorest farmers, paying a fair price to ensure that the cost associated with climate resilience farming is actually met. So I think it's you know, you're seeing vulnerable people facing some of the hardest impacts of climate change today. But with these new requirements, we're not necessarily seeing the payments to implement these changes being passed over to the farmers themselves. So I think it's important to really understand that you can't expect farmers to change overnight, especially if you're not paying them the prices needed to make these changes overnight. And it's not that we don't see farmers willing to make these changes. I think farmers are actively willing to make these changes because they're facing the brunt of climate change more than ourselves in the UK are facing. So yeah, I'll end there. But I think we all know that the impacts of climate change are really heavy, and that these solutions that we do have, which is exciting, we're seeing so many innovative ideas on how to attack and really reduce the impacts of climate change. But how do we do that in a fair way is, I think, at the heart of what fair trade is aiming to do with our environmental work.
Thank you. That's brilliant. And actually brings me to the next question, which is, how far do you think we are from internalizing the costs that are linked to climate change and environmental degradation? And where do you think this internalization should happen? Do you think it's like the bigger manufacturers or retailers that should be bearing the costs because they're having very wide margins? Or do you think the prices are too low and the consumers should be paying more for what they're buying because it's that expensive for the people producing it and for the environment?
Yeah, this is a hard question, but I don't think we're close to internalizing the cost, I will say that. And I think farmers and producers today, especially with the EUDR legislation, because that is in effect and there is an expectation, right, by the end of this year that especially farmers in the cocoa and coffee industries, as well as industries outside of fair trade like palm oil, are being expected to meet. And I don't think the cost of it was necessarily considered. And farmers and producers are concerned about what this means for them and being able to pay for things like geolocating their farms. And so, no, I would say we're not necessarily close to internalizing the cost. And I think it's really important, especially as we're seeing a growth in legislation around this space, not just in the EU, but in Australia and in the UK itself, right? We're seeing deforestation legislation come into place in the UK with the human rights and environmental due diligence legislation. Globally, we're seeing that increase. I think it is imperative that cost is considered. What does this mean? And to your question of who should pay, I think it shouldn't just be one actor. I don't think I can sit here confidently and say consumers should be the one bearing the brunt of this cost when we're sitting in a recession in the UK and the cost of living crisis is still very much present. And I think we can all, as students who might be listening to this, as someone who works in the NGO space, I think we all are feeling that effect. So it's not just up to consumers to pay more for products that are ethically and sustainably produced. I don't think it just lies with the consumer, but I also don't think it just lies with businesses. And I don't think it just lies with the traders in the middle of the supply chain. I think the way we see things today as well is that cost keeps getting pushed down low into the upper streams of the supply chain. I think it's actually that we need to take collective action to share costs, right? We shouldn't be placing undue burden at any point of the supply chain, but instead, I think we need to think holistically across the supply chain and how do you spread cost across the supply chain? How do you incorporate civil society actors like fair trade? How do you incorporate the government in regulating these costs? And how do you share that burden as a system? This is a global issue. We're all experiencing the impact of climate change. And so it's not up to just one person to bear the cost of what it means to fix this issue. And which is easier said than done. I think I could talk about that on a podcast, what it means to collaborate in an industry that is very siloed is difficult. But I think as fair trade and as other civil society organizations, we can really serve as a facilitator of this collaboration. I think that's where the strongest is, that we can bring people together in a pre-competitive space to share these costs. I think one of the most innovative things that we're doing at Fair Trade, which later in 2023, actually the CMA gave green light to our pilot called Shared Impact. And it is what it is what the name says it to be. It's shared impact. How can we create a pact of people, of retailers in this instance, to come together and share the cost, the burden of what it means to invest in a group of communities who are working towards environmental sustainability, who are doing really great work in upholding human rights and protecting their communities against exploitation like child labor and forced labor. So I think these are all things that fair trade is working to do. And I think other civil society organizations, it's where we're our strongest. So it's easier said than done to share the burden, but I think there are really great ways to do that, and fair trade is working to do that. And I think I guess that's my call to other civil society organizations, is how can we bring people together? How can we bring all areas of the supply chain together? But also, how can we work together? I think we have to, you know, action speaks louder than words. So how can we as civil society organizations work together to solve these issues and share the burden as well?
That was fantastic. That was such a great call to action, I think, and such a nice way to finish this part of the podcast. We'd really love to know what kind of advice you would have for students listening to this who are interested in a career in human rights or environmental and social governance or in the NGO space.
Yeah, this is really a big growing space and definitely an exciting one to be a part of. My everyday is very different. So I would definitely encourage more and more people to be involved in ESG and human rights. I think my biggest recommendation, and I think I talked about it at the beginning when I introduced myself, I think I've been on a real journey of like exploring different areas of what it means to be in my career. And I think what I found is that the most important thing is to find your niche. What is it in this space that you are passionate about? I think it's really easy for a lot of us to pinpoint a topic or an issue that we care about. I'm deeply passionate about eradicating forced labor, for instance, but it's so much more than that. I think there's so many aspects to the issue that you can focus on. It could be policy, it could be innovation, it could be development work. For me, it was and still is, how do I support businesses to do the right thing, and how do we embed ESG into their operations and supply chains? I think once you find that niche, it's going to be a lot easier to navigate career opportunities and really land that dream job. So yeah, I would encourage listeners to really think about that. So think about beyond the issue itself, but what part of this issue do I want to focus on? Because when you get under the hood of it all, there's so many different places that you can serve as part of the solution to the issue that you care about. So I think once you find that, it's going to be a lot easier to find the right job. And it makes it a lot more interesting to have a conversation with potential employers as well, because you really know where you think you can make a difference in the issue itself. It's all great and dandy to say I care about modern slavery and I want to prevent modern slavery, when in fact there are so many ways you can do that. So I would encourage listeners to really spend some time and reflect on what is that specific area I want to invest my time in, and where is it based on my position, how I grew up, where my strengths are, that I can really be a part of the solution. So yeah, find your niche is probably my biggest piece of advice.
That's very helpful. And I think it's going to be very helpful to a big part of our audience. So thank you so much for that advice. And thank you so much for taking the time to answer all our questions on fair trade. I definitely have a much better idea of what's behind that small logo I see on products I buy. So that was very enlightening. And I'm so glad we got to do this podcast. Should we, Steffi, do the yes or no questions?
Yeah, that would be fantastic. Yeah.
Of course, Becky. So the idea is, like, if you can answer them by yes or no, or by a very short answer.
Becky, we'd love to ask you some yes or no questions now. But of course, if you can't answer yes or no, then feel free to answer in a short sentence or with a maybe. So our first question for you is, as a consumer, does buying fair trade products make a significant difference to the livelihoods of people and communities in the global south?
I'd say yes. We can all be part of what we call be the change. And by making small decisions of changing what bag of coffee you buy, hopefully this podcast showed what that logo really means. And you can be confident that farmers were paid a fair price and received additional sums of money to invest in sustainability.
Brilliant. Thank you. And secondly, do you think that businesses are doing enough to tackle inequities in their supply chains?
I think there's always more to be done. I don't want to say no, because I do know businesses are working really hard to do the right thing, but there's always more that can be done. And I think that's why fair trade partners with these businesses in the first place, is how can we support them on that journey?
Fantastic. That's really interesting. And finally, do you think that it's realistic to expect supply chains to become equitable in the near future? So in the next 10 years or 20 years or so?
That's a hard one. I want to be an optimist and say yes. I think if we're continuing on this journey of new legislation and businesses actually taking the time to do due diligence and make investments in things like living income and living wages, I think in the next 20 years, we can see significant change and hope for that equality that we all really strive for.
Okay, that's great. Thank you. I think that's pretty much a wrap on the podcast. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was great to chat.
Thank you so much, Becky Milan, for joining us in this new episode. I hope you all enjoyed it, and we look forward to seeing you in the next episode at Peel UK.